it's only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We start out first with the Aboriginal Nations oppose expansion of Canada's tar sands. Shell Canada is planning to expand its Jackpine tar sands mining operations, but several Aboriginal Nations who live there fiercely protest these plans. Steve Kerwood hears why from Chelsea Fluke, the executive director of the Sierra Club Prairie Chapter. And then after that, Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, talks with John Hoffmeister, CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy and a former president of Shell Oil Company. Yes, activist Bill McKibben and former president of the Shell Oil Company, John Hoffmeister, discuss the current state of energy and technology. By both Bill McKibben and Hoffmeister agree that the world needs better energy alternatives. They disagree on when the needed changes will happen. And then after that, tapping volcanoes for energy. Scientists are exploring new technologies to harness the power of dormant volcanoes for geothermal energy. Dave Blackwell, an earth sciences professor at Southern Methodist University, tells Steve Kerwood that volcanoes could power millions of homes.
The tar sands of Canada are so rich, the nation is second only to Saudi Arabia for proven crude oil reserves. One of the companies developing the sands, Shell Canada, wants to expand its operations. But this region is also home to several indigenous First Nations communities who fiercely protest Shell's plans. The Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, ACFN, has challenged the expansion plans in court. Chelsea Fluck is executive director of the Sierra Club Prairie Chapter. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Now tell me, the First Nation objects to Shell's plans to expand its Jackpine tar sands mine. Why?
Well, the complaints are numerous. It stems back to the earlier Jackpine mine, where Shell made an agreement with the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation on mitigating impacts. And Shell, according to ACFN, has broken that agreement. When it comes time to making a decision on a new project, how can the First Nation expect any of its concerns to be addressed when, even when you sign a deal with the exact same company, that they don't honor those agreements?
Well, what are they saying didn't happen? I mean, what does it actually look like up there?
The Shell project is open pit mining. The new expansion requires mining out 21 kilometers of the Muskeg River, which is, you know, aside from mining out a river and the environmental impacts, there are all kinds of cultural significance to that area of the river itself for the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation people. So they are saying no to this project, and they want to be able to assert that right to say no, as it's enshrined in treaty rights and constitutional protections. and that's why they're raising this case now.
So the First Nation argues that it would be illegal for the Canadian government to give the okay to expand these tar sands mines. What's the basis for that?
Well, the legal basis stems back to treaty rights between the Crown and treaty people, or the First Peoples of this land. Those agreements were enshrined in the Constitution when Canada brought the Constitution home. And it was sort of written in under Section 35 that treaty rights people and Indigenous people of this land have special constitutional consideration for, you know, development of their land, for any kind of disturbance of their land. And it really tried to enshrine the idea that so long as the grass grows and the rivers flow and the sun shines, that the people can be there time immemorial. So parts of these projects are having such massive impacts on the land, on the water, on the wildlife that people are still dependent on. And so they are seeing more and more that their medicines are disappearing, the water levels are getting lower, they're not sure if it's safe to eat the fish or drink the water. They're finding moose and other animals that they eat with various tumors and lesions and things. So the basis for them saying no to this is that it's constitutionally enshrined for them to do so. However, we have a federal government that is pretty much hell-bent on developing these projects at any and all costs.
So if I understand you correctly, this treaty was made with the Crown. In other words, it must have been Queen Victoria of England. So this is more than 100 years ago.
And so part of that process, when Canada made its own constitution separate from the British constitution, part of what was written into it was the recognition that there were past agreements and that they were going to do their best to honor those agreements. This, however, you know, is running up against the history of various pieces of legislation like the Indian Act, which restricted status. It didn't let Native people vote. It restricts many things about their lives, and they have to have status cards. And Canada has a long history of residential school systems where they sought to literally kill the Indian in the child, as it was said in the original documents. So there's this long process where there's a cultural and very historical genocide that's happening against these people, where if you can take them off their land, if you can displace them from practicing their traditional ways, then those treaty rights no longer exist.
Now, how has the Canadian government reacted to the First Nations charge in this case of regarding these tar sands?
They are there as interveners. They are also there as the judge, jury, and executioner of the project. So there's a bit of a conflict of interest in our opinion. One of the former ministers, Jim Prentice, who left his post, he penned a letter to our mainstream media here in Canada saying that, you know, the duty to consult has not been met in these projects, and that this leaves a lot of these projects open to a lot of financial risk, and that this has basically exposed the public to a lot of that risk, because if in the event that these treaty rights are pushed for and that people do push for them to be respected, then a lot of these land leases mean that the public would have to reimburse these companies for the land leases that they purchased illegitimately.
What does this situation mean now for the future of resource development and Indigenous people's rights in Canada?
Well, I think that there's been a couple test cases at the Supreme Court level where various communities have asserted their treaty rights and taken it all the way to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court has left things open to rulings, very much so, that would favor the ACFN in this case. So I think that this could really set a precedent in the tar sands region alone for more and more communities to stand up to these major oil companies and to expect that their voices will be heard.
Chelsea, what's the best possible outcome from this from your perspective?
Well, I think the best possible outcome from our perspective at Sierra Club would be that we would see a First Nation asserting its rights to say no to a project, and that would get respected. It's also enshrined in the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to say no to these projects with free, prior, and informed consent. So I think that Canada has at least a moral obligation to look at itself and to look at the UN Declaration and start actually taking meaningful action on those moral imperatives. So that's our hope there. And if it just so happens that First Nations are deciding that they want to protect their land and their way of life, then there's environmental benefits to that as well.
Chelsea Flook is the executive director of the Sierra Club Prairie chapter in Edmonton, Alberta. Thanks so much for taking the time, Chelsea.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
In published reports, Shell Canada said that though expanding would cause substantial habitat loss, it has extensive plans to mitigate the damage.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, and John Hoffmeister, CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy, discuss the climate and energy. Yes, activist Bill McKibben and former president of Shell Oil Company, John Hoffmeister, discuss the current state of energy and technology.
Welcome to Climate One, a conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Greg Dalton. coal mining, gas prices, and oil drilling were all frequently mentioned in the recent presidential campaign. But the consequences of burning fossil fuels were not. For the first time since 1988, climate disruption was not mentioned in the presidential or vice presidential debates. And then came Sandy. Comments by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Governor Andrew Cuomo ended the climate silence and put carbon pollution back in the national conversation. Some observers say Sandy will be a game changer in America's love-hate relationship with hydrocarbons. Others say concern will quickly fade with time. And many are wondering how President Obama will address energy and climate in a second term. Over the next hour, we'll discuss pointing America toward a prosperous and low-carbon future with a live audience at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. We are joined by one of the country's leading environmental advocates and a Texas oil man. John Hoffmeister is CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy and former president of Shell Oil Company, the U.S. subsidiary of Royal Dutch Shell. He's also author of the book Why We Hate Oil Companies, Straight Talk from an Energy Insider. Bill McKibben is founder of the advocacy group 350.org and author of Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Please welcome them to Climate One. I'd like to begin by asking you both to respond to a recent article that appeared shortly after the election in Politico. And the lead of that article was, "The energy world is wondering which Obama it will get in a second term, the liberal that Greens love or the moderate that oil industry tolerates." John Hoffmeister, which President Obama do you think we will see?
Let me start by saying the relationship between the president and the oil industry is viscerally negative. Viscerally negative. The oil industry is one industry that candidate Obama, Senator Obama, has blasted from time when he first became in the public domain. And having dealt directly with the president when he was senator and having had conversations with him, this is a subject that he finds great difficulty with. His single-handed determination to tax the oil companies, which did get a lot of campaign attention during the course of both campaigns, 2008 as well as 2012, I think is reflective of what he considers a deliberate animosity. It's a group of executives he's never met with. While he's met with many other executives from many other industries, he's never met with the oil industry. I'm debating whether we should try to set up such a meeting between now and, say, the end of the year to try to get off on a good foot next year, because we've got four more important years. It was announced this week that the U.S. has produced more oil in terms of quantity than at any time since 1994, based upon developments on state lands with private landowners, not federal efforts, 6.8 million barrels a day. But I think the problem we face is there is essentially a standoff between the oil and gas industry and the president, because the actions and the words are inconsistent.
Because he says he supports expanding domestic drilling.
He says he does. The actions are completely inconsistent with the words from the perspective of the oil industry. And I think there's a lot of symbolism in the words, but I don't think there's a lot of intent in the words. The question will be in the new administration is, I think, how much the animosity will play out through increased regulation. And the industry is expecting considerably increased regulation. This is a very unfortunate circumstance for the American economy and the American people, in my opinion, because a cooperative effort, one that meets both sustainability objectives and feeds the existing machine. Let's remember, we have an existing machine that needs to be fed, meaning the 250 million cars on the road, the tens of millions of trucks and so forth. Those aren't going to disappear anytime soon. And we can either feed the machine with imported oil or feed the machine with domestic oil. The oil and gas industry is really neutral on the issue of domestic or imported. I happen to be very one-sided in the sense that domestic production does a lot of good for the country, provided it's done under sustainable regulatory regime, and I'm fine with increasing the regulations if it's consistent across the industry. But to not develop our own domestic resources, knowing we're going to need more oil and more gas going forward, is inconsistent, I think, with the economic objectives of the rest of the country.
Bill McKibben, do you think we'll see what kind of posture from President Obama on energy?
I think the question comes down to whether or not he takes seriously in the end the climate change issue, which is the underlying problem here. It is the legacy issue of all legacy issues, because it will last into geologic time. And it is going to be very difficult because of the incredible obstructive power of the fossil fuel industry. We're in a real box. They've for 25 years kept us from doing anything about it, and now we're going to have to do big things if we have any hope of heading it off. We're going to have to make an all-out effort not to produce more coal and gas and oil here and around the world, because we've already got way more carbon in the atmosphere than we can deal with. Since I wrote the first book about all this 25 years ago, sometimes I have to resist the impulse to say, if only you'd paid attention then, you know, because there are a lot of things that we could have done 25 years ago that we can't do now because we've filled the atmosphere. Look what happened in this last year. The most important story in the last year was not, in the end, the presidential election. The most important story of the last year was, A, the warmest year in American history. B, epic drought across the most fertile farmland in the world. We made it too hot to grow corn and soybeans across the Midwest. C, we broke one of the largest physical features on Earth. By the time the melt season ended in the Arctic in September, basically summer sea ice in the Arctic was clearly on its way out. And D, as a kind of metaphor for all the other extreme weather of the year, Hurricane Sandy. Truly amazing new set of images for our mental scrapbook of what this looks like. The greatest city in the world underwater, water pouring into the subway tunnels, into the Holland Tunnel. I mean, you know, would that we had listened when this happened in Bangladesh or Pakistan or Africa or any of the other places where we've seen this kind of stuff. But when it happened in Manhattan, people looked at it in a different way. And the proof of that, I think, was the cover of that Radical Rag Business Week, the week after, in big yellow letters. It said, "It's global warming, stupid. Global warming is the only sort of existential question that we face right now, and the only question is whether we get down to work on it or not." And, the president will have some say on that, but the rest of us will have more say. If we build the movement that forces action on it, then we'll get somewhere. If not, then the incredible political and financial power of the fossil fuel industry will do what it's done for the last quarter century, which is obstruct real progress.
John Hofmeister, two things in there. Is there urgency around climate, or do you believe this is something that will happen over decades in time? And has the oil industry been blocking progress, defending its incumbent technologies?
I'm not a climatologist. I do not have the science in my mind or the understanding to profess the linkage between what is arguably a changing climate and the relationship to carbon in the atmosphere. My mind can't connect it. I'm a practical person. What I can connect is the irresponsible waste management or lack of waste management that occurs in this country and around the world. It is irresponsible of any human being to pollute their neighbor's air, water, or land. And yet we have as a society continuously, and getting worse, not better, we are polluting our neighbor's land. When we prepare a meal, we make a mess in the kitchen, we clean up the kitchen. Both we clear the air, we wash the dishes, we get rid of the dirty water. What we don't do from the standpoint of the economic relationship in the social relationship is require that that be done in all of our activities. And so I understand the point of global scientists. I understand the point of global warming. I understand the point of public policy needed to address this ominous forecast that Bill describes. But if you can't get down to the basic practical balance between managing our waste, which can be done. We have the technology. We've done wonders on physical waste. We've done a lot of good work on liquid waste. But we have done marginally almost nothing on gaseous waste. And that's what I describe in my book. I think that we can and should aggressively, across the board, deal with waste management. Because absent that, I disagree with Bill on the fossil fuel industry operating some homogeneous fashion, because I was part of the United States Climate Action Partnership during my time at Shell, which advocated a cap-and-trade system and actually helped design the cap-and-trade system that went up to Waxman and Markey until the process of the Congress created an unsupportable bill. And the Senate didn't even take it up. And the House barely passed it because it was unworkable in its design versus what was presented to them when it was originally designed. So I'm not opposed to climate change advocacy, but I don't think you get there through rhetoric. You get there through action.
Well, one way to get there is to internalize the cost of fossil fuels. We currently use the atmosphere as an unpriced sewer, and that would mean raising the price of fossil fuels and perhaps affecting fossil fuel company profits, et cetera. You're head of a company called Citizens for Affordable Energy. If we start to internalize that waste, prices may go up.
And I think that's an affordable proposition. Because we're healthier, we drive more fuel-efficient vehicles, et cetera, and we shift away from the internal combustion engine. If we cannot get off the internal combustion engine with all the technology that we have available to us, shame on us. And so I'm a strong advocate of moving away from the internal combustion engine, which eliminates 40% of the oil we consume. But getting support for that, it is pricier in the beginning until we reach the tipping point of scale manufacturing. But whether it's battery cars or hydrogen fuel cells or public transportation, we don't need internal combustion engines any longer than it takes to transition away from them. That would be a big step forward.
Well, I mean, the reason that we haven't made that transition is not because we lack the technology. It's because the fossil fuel industry has made sure that we keep the price of fossil fuel artificially low. This is the only industry in the world that doesn't have to pay to take out its waste. And they have defended that right zealously for a very long time. They were the biggest contributors to this last election cycle, just like the one before. And most of that money, U.S. Chamber of Commerce was the biggest contributor in the 2010 election cycle, busily defending against any serious legislation on climate. They went 93% of their campaign donations to climate deniers. We need to face once and for all the fact that we've got to now keep carbon in the ground, that we cannot be doing what we're doing. So, I mean, think, for example, about what Shell did in, 7 or 8 years ago. It looked around at the fact that global warming was melting the Arctic, and instead of saying we need to transition into becoming a renewable energy company, they said this is a great opportunity to go up and apply for permits to drill in this melting Arctic so we can get some more carbon out of it. In fact, Shell sold off its renewable energy divisions in the last part of the last decade. That's the kind of stuff that we just can't keep doing. And saying that, one can't connect in one's mind carbon and the changes going around on the planet now just isn't acceptable anymore.
Do you know what's worth fighting for when it's not worth dying for? Does it take your breath away and you feel yourself suffocating? Does the pain weigh out the pride and you look for a place to hide? Did someone break your heart inside? You're in ruins.
time to live and let die. And you can't get another try. Something inside this heart has died. You're in ruins.
And now for something completely different.